Well, I want to welcome everyone. I don't know if it's ironic that we're having a talk on Our Friend the Sun on the coldest day of winter so far.
But it's sunny.
But it is indeed sunny, and it is heartening to see you here, and more heartwarming to have this talk today. I'd like to introduce you to Dr. Tanya Ann Woloshin, who's currently a postdoctoral fellow here in the Department of Art History and Communication Studies, and she's working under the supervision of Professor Mary Hunter. And she's being funded by the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada. So thank you, taxpayers of Canada.
Thank you.
She completed her PhD in 2008 at the University of Nottingham in England, and her dissertation was entitled Vers la Lumière, Painters and Patients on the Côte d'Azur. Her BA and MA were completed at Carleton, which is perhaps the only city colder than Montreal at the moment, in Ottawa, and Queen's Universities, respectively. Her postdoctoral research focuses on shared perceptions amongst artists, physicians, and scientists of sunlight. That is, the intersections of light aesthetics, light therapeutics, and light physics, particularly during the 1890 to 1920 period. The present exhibition, Our Friend the Sun, Images of Light Therapeutics, from the Ulster Library Collection, 1901-1944, has been curated by Dr. Woloshin as part of her research interests with the help and support of the Ulster Library staff. And after the talk, you're all invited to a guided tour of the exhibition itself, and the exhibition will be here until the end of June. So there's plenty of time to come back and enjoy it more and in more detail and appreciate the different layers of work that's gone into this. Anyway, without further ado, here's Dr. Woloshin.
Thanks, Chris.
You're welcome.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here with all of you. And it's a welcome sight to see so many interested in so esoteric a topic as the history of light therapeutics. Research can be such an isolating experience, and for some time I've wanted to share these images with others and have an open discussion about them. This is why I was so delighted to have the opportunity to act as a guest curator here at the Osler and to put this exhibition together with its wonderful staff, so thank you. What is presented within the exhibition, as Chris explained, forms part of my current postdoctoral research, which is funded by a two-year Shirk Fellowship. And as he explained, I am in the Art History and Communication Studies department with Mary Hunter. More and more these days, I find myself outside of my usual art historical comfort zone, submerged in the history of medicine and trying to stay afloat. But I also seem to mind less and less as I come to understand that the boundaries between these disciplines are permeable and fluid, allowing for rich discussions and intersections. But it takes a place like the Ulster Library to facilitate the join. The four glass cabinets and three individual cases outside the main entrance may seem humble in comparison to a fully fledged gallery or a museum space. But as I've learned over the past few months, it still takes quite a lot of time and thought to plan an exhibition, no matter its size. I was offered the opportunity to put this show together during my very first week of my postdoc. And after the first wave of panic passed, I realized this was a unique way to organize my research schedule. Since September, I've let the exhibition drive my research rather than follow it. So what has resulted is very much a beginning to a larger project rather than an end or a summary. In this way, the images, images which I feel have active voices rather than stand as passive reflections, still have a lot to say. And in as much as I've positioned them in certain places and selected which ones to include in the limited space, they haven't yet been scripted to play finalized roles. This is one of the main reasons I've included a visitor's book at the entrance of the exhibition, and I encourage viewers to record their thoughts and impressions there. I want to remain open and even undecided about the visual material because I feel that there are many directions I could take it, and because most scholars are actually not given the opportunity to put their research material into a public forum like an exhibition, which invites multiple perspectives from a diverse audience. What do I want to present this afternoon, then, is a summary of the exhibition, as well as focus on some themes emerging from the early visual culture of heliotherapy, or natural sunlight therapy, and phototherapy, or artificial light therapy. But first, a little bit about that history. So I'll begin with heliotherapy. Popular history books tell us that the act of exposing one's body to the sun's rays dates to the 1920s. As a tourist fad for the purposes of beautification, attributed to the chic and avant-garde like Coco Chanel. In these secondary sources, sun tanning is historically positioned as novel, fashionable, and devoid of any real medical basis. Primary medical texts of the late 1890s and early 1900s, however, tell a very different story. In his 1910 book, Light Therapeutics, Dr. John Harvey Kellogg of Kellogg's Cornflakes fame declared that he'd been using sunbaths in Michigan since 1876. Indeed, there's a wealth of primary texts and images that suggest a much earlier beginning to the history of the sunbath, many of which are presented here from the Osler's library collection. That history is also intertwined with late 19th century developments in laboratory medicine, the discovery of germ theory, and experiments in light physics. Physicians were aware that scientists such as Arthur Downes, Thomas Blunt, Louis Pasteur, and Robert Koch had published studies on the antibacterial properties of light. Koch had demonstrated that ultraviolet rays destroyed bacteria, most importantly the tuberculous bacillus, which of course he was discovered. The experiments on the destructive action of light on bacteria by Downes and Blunt in 1877 are referenced frequently in heliotherapeutic handbooks. Irrefutable proof of the efficacy of sunlight in combating TB. If sunlight could kill bacteria spread onto a microscope's glass slide, it could kill bacteria living in the blood and tissues of the tubercular patient. So the logic went. Penetrating the epidermal layers, the sun's rays could activate the body's vital forces, initiating a reaction that would spread throughout it entirely. Physicians described sunlight as a source that activated nutrition, excited the tissues, increased circulation of the blood, and improved respiration. In this way, it was understood as a natural regenerative agent. Heliotherapy and phototherapy emerged during the 1890s out of intense experimentation, and internationally so. And from what I can gather from the material, they remained experimental treatments, with no one system or method prevailing over all others. The positions of the patients, the equipment used on them, and exposure times to the light differed remarkably. Now, that's not to say that particular physicians did not systematize their own method. Known as the high priest of modern sun worshippers, Dr. Auguste Rollier created several outdoor sanatoria in the Swiss mountains for tubercular adults and children, beginning in 1903. Rollier advocated a total body treatment of natural sunlight, not simply for specific lesions on the surface of the body, but for a holistic, immune-boosting regeneration of the whole body. He illustrated his method by means of a highly artistic anatomical drawing of a male figure, sectioning areas of the body according to sunlight exposure. So as you can see here, this would go day by day and minute by minute. So the first day, we would just expose the feet for 5 minutes. And then the next day, 10 minutes on the feet, and then up to the calves, and then so forth and so forth as the days progressed. And this was the form of acclimatizing. And you can see here then that it was a strict and a progressive process of exposure to sunlight, starting from the bottom up and always avoiding the head for fear of sunstroke. Now, at the same time that Rollier was opening his sanatoria in the Swiss mountains, an establishment entitled Sylvabelle, or Beautiful Forest, in La Croix-Valmer near Saint-Tropez on the Côte d'Azur opened in 1904 as an explicitly nature sanatorium under the supervision of a Dr. Albert Monteus. And in fact, it still exists as a children's hospital. Monteus wrote extensively on heliotherapy and other natural therapies. He wrote a book that was called Air, Light, and Sunbaths, and it was first published in 1904. It was translated into English as early as 1907, and it was republished in 1911. It was Monteus' hope to popularize heliotherapy for the benefit of all citizens suffering from chronic illness, and his goal was made obvious in the modification of his 1911 republication. So you can see here it is now titled The Usage at Home or for Yourself of Light, Air, and Sunbaths. And it says it's also for a matter of daily hygiene. So you can see here this emphasis on the home treatment, on the daily use, and on the chez-soi, meant in a way that one could take individual responsibility for their own cure. So for Montaigne, one could take a bain de soleil in the bedroom, in the hotel room, or in the garden. But it seems to me that, however he suggested that people could take responsibility for their own cure, the lengthy directions and the detailed schedules inside of these manuals made it clear that they could only do so if armed with the right medical knowledge. Niels Ryberg Finsen is known as the inventor of phototherapy, or artificial light therapy. And for this, he won the Nobel Prize for Medicine in 1903. He was the third person to do so, and sadly, he died the next year from Pick's disease. He began experimenting with natural light, as you can see here, and then soon afterwards, artificial light, from the early 1890s in order to treat lupus, which was tuberculosis of the skin. In 1896, he founded the Medical Light Institute in Copenhagen, and it was later known as the Finsen Institute, and it was funded by the state, which gives some indication of how quickly his research was widely accepted and encouraged, I think. Finsen's experiments with light, however, began with an observation of its negative influence on variola, or smallpox. He realized that if the patient was placed in a room totally devoid of all but red light, within the first stages of smallpox, which is known as the stage of vesiculation or the blistering time of the skin, the disease actually wouldn't develop into the next stage, the stage of separation, in which the pus would discharge from the small blisters. By doing so, the patient could heal with little or no scarring. To do this, he created a room where all but the windows were covered by thick red cloth or a dense red glass to filter out everything except the red rays, rather like a photographer's darkroom. And interestingly, and perhaps not surprisingly, I don't actually have any photos of that taking place. In fact, one of his American followers, Dr. Charles Warren Allen, whose work is also featured in the exhibition, remarked, and I quote, "At the present time, Finsen does not consider a red room for treating variola adequate unless it fulfills the requirement of a photographic dark or developing room. As a test for the quality of light, he suspends a photographic plate in the room in which the patient is being treated, and if it becomes blurred, he regards the method as faulty and does not expect good therapeutic results," end quote. Finsen even experimented with additional filters and stain solutions that he would put on the glass, again, reminiscent to me of photographic experiments. Finsen explained that the red light of the spectrum was weakest in terms of concentrated chemical action. Red light is the furthest on the spectrum from UV and violet light, which are highest in chemical or actinic action as well as bactericidal action. And he, after sort of understanding that he could use red light in this capacity for variola, he decided to actually move to the other side of the spectrum and concentrate on UV light, and he began to focus on treating lupus. Finsen published his findings throughout the 1890s in Danish, and later these were gathered and translated into English as early as 1901 in a book simply entitled Phototherapy. The French version appeared in 1903. It's on show downstairs, though shorter works of his had already been published in French and German before 1899. You can see that these before and after photographs of lupus patients were included here for their documentary function. And in fact, they appear very frequently in all of his publications. They record the progress of the treatment and of the healing, and they are evidence of the efficacy of the light therapy, and I think in many ways are very convincing before and after photographs. Finsen explained that he began with natural sunlight modified through glass, but after realizing actually that UV can't pass through ordinary glass, he switched to quartz lenses. He later moved to electric light devices needing more concentrated and readily available rays at his disposal. And interestingly, he also developed skin compressors, which you can see here on the lower right-hand side. And that was in order to compress the skin and the tissues around the lesion to drain the blood away from the face, which he discovered greatly facilitated the treatment by allowing the light to penetrate deeper into the interior. And in this image, you can see actually that it's being used on the cheek of a male patient on the left-hand side, in the left foreground. A nurse holds his head still so that the long tube of the machine can point directly at the compressed area. And both the patient and the nurse wear protective goggles to shield their eyes from the damaging UV rays. I'm kind of fascinated by these goggles, actually, as a kind of accessory of phototherapy, because they always remind me of images of mad scientists that happen shortly thereafter. So just a sideline. Now, Kellogg himself went to Copenhagen in 1899 and 1902 to visit Finsen at his Light Institute. At the Battle Creek Sanitarium, Kellogg continued to experiment with natural and artificial light, inventing his own machines and special devices. In fact, what I've done is one of the cases in the exhibition features images of different kinds of lamps, which varied significantly in size and form. In reading advertisement pamphlets on these various lamps, enthusiastic claims from each manufacturer or doctor declared that product superiority over all others. And by the 1920s, phototherapy lamps seemed to have entered mainstream consumerism for home use. And I just love this ad, because on the right-hand side, it actually advocates buying this for your children as the best Christmas gift you can give them. This is a 1930s ad. However, our exhibition showpiece is a quartz lamp of circa 1920 to 1925. It's the Hanau Solux lamp. It was donated to the Oslo Library by Dr. Shanna Rosenblatt Sorks and Dr. Theodore Sorks, who I'm very honored to have here today. The lamp originally belonged to Dr. Rosenblatt Sorks' mother, Dr. Ginda Rosenblatt, a Russian physician who was practicing at the time in Romania, in a region now known as the Moldavian Republic, during the 1920s. The lamp was used on many patients, apparently for any and all complaints, but it was especially used for pulmonary tuberculosis. She and her family immigrated to Canada soon afterwards, bringing the lamp with them, but apparently never using it again. And we found an example of it being used in a 1926 article in the Annals of Surgery, which is kind of interesting, so we've put those side by side. Now, this, of course, is also the period during which Wilhelm Conrad Röntgen was credited with the official and published study of X-rays in 1895, for which he won the first Nobel Prize in Physics, though he was among many scientists conducting experiments on rays in the 1890s. Soon afterwards, Marie Curie discovered polonium and radium, which are radioactive substances, and these greatly enhanced the development of radiotherapy. For her research in physics and chemistry, she was awarded 2 Nobel Prizes. This was therefore, to my mind, a very fertile period in the field of light physics and light therapeutics, sanctioned by the Nobel Foundation and internationally recognized. Now, the X-ray was not considered a light ray, per se, but it was quickly utilized for therapeutic purposes, for radiotherapy, which, of course, we still use today, primarily for malignant cancers. But its potential for medical imaging developed side by side with its therapeutic potential. And within the same manuals on light therapy are sections on phototherapy and radiotherapy, complete with diagnostic images, which are photographs and X-rays. So both the technology that facilitated the therapy and that which allowed for its visualization were one and the same. This relationship between light and the visual is even more intriguing and layered when we consider that photography itself as an art and a science was first described as heliography, or writing with light. And, of course, we know of Finsen's early experiments with variola and his requirements that the treatment room follow those of a dark room. Within the medical manuals on light therapeutics are direct references to photographic processes and X-ray imaging techniques, so that in many ways I view the topic of light therapy as a locus of art, science, and medical histories. Now I'll talk about some themes. Significantly, these physicians asserted the ancient quasi-magical origins of light therapeutics at the same time as they advocated it as a modern therapeutic of sound scientific rationale. So too did they posit it as a welcome, pleasurable, and comfortable experience while simultaneously including photographs of patients strapped down, exposed to the sun almost nude in winter, or subjected to gun-like electric machines. Major themes are present within the primary literature and images around both heliotherapy and phototherapy, tensions and inconsistencies that I think deserve further exploration. But at this point, I have more questions than answers. What, for example, is natural about these natural therapies? And is our relationship with the sun instinctual? And are these images documentary or in fact highly constructed, even manipulated representations of light therapy that pass themselves off as natural, pleasurable, and liberating. In these manuals, do the texts and the images correlate or challenge each other? I've come across many references to heliotherapy as an ancient practice, as originating in primitive sun worship. Sir J. Henry Galvin, for example, stated, and I quote, "In all ages there have been sun worshippers. It could not be otherwise. Terrestrial life craves for the golden rays," end quote. Now, Galvin described the highly regimented and surveyed medical processes of light therapeutics as something instinctive and thus natural. Investing in natural means and natural forces was the premise behind heliotherapy and, at least initially, behind phototherapy. Kellogg himself referred to his system as the physiologic or natural method, yet he warned his readers that the use of simple elements, light, air, and water, was by no means a simple task for the layman. And I quote, "The application of the physiologic method requires much more than simply a knowledge of the techniques of bath, electricity, and movements. It especially requires a knowledge of physiology and an intelligent grasp of all of the resources of modern medical science," end quote. Another physician, Caleb Saleby, put it more bluntly, "In spite of its apparent simplicity, the practice of heliotherapy demands great attention to detail and constant supervision," end quote. Rollier's exposure chart suggests that he and his staff monitored his patients intensely. Yet in photographs accompanying his various publications, patients are shown receiving sun treatment in surprisingly different, even odd circumstances. For example, note the contrast between the next two images. So in the first, we have a child strapped to a bed, wearing the kind of requisite loincloth coverage only for the alpine air, and the nurses are wheeling him onto a terrace to receive his treatment, and he's about to join his brethren over there for the terrace treatments. Now in the second, and this is a drawing made after a photograph, which is kind of interesting in itself, children are skiing in the same loincloths, exposing their bodies while engaging in physical activity on the mountain slopes. They are seemingly unmonitored, free, and left to their own devices outside of the sanatorium grounds. Happy, unfettered, and liberated, such patients appear a far cry from the drawn figure of Rollier's systematized chart. But one of my favorite images is this one. It's of a young girl almost nude on the balcony of one of Rollier's Lysen sanatoria. Now, as a patient at his facility, the child in this photograph would have followed a strict medical regime throughout the day, and we know that because he listed what that schedule was hour by hour in his books. But does the photograph suggest this? It absolutely doesn't. With her giddy, playful gestures and shameless presentation of her near-naked body, she expresses the feeling of total bodily liberation. The extreme contrast of light and shadow across her body and on the platform indicates she's receiving the direct impact of brilliant, unobstructed sunshine. It is so bright that, in this photograph, her upright arm loses contour, dissolved by the light. So too does the whiteness of her loincloth contrast with her bronze skin, denoting that she is familiar with the practice of sun tanning and that actually she's healing very well. And I really love this image because I like to think of it in relation to tourist photographs that are happening at the same time. For example, this one by Roger Broders from 1931 to advertise the Côte d'Azur. You can see in both of these cases what we're looking at here are something that is quite simply not a scientific document. In other words, this image is unnecessary for scientific purposes. It is purely aesthetic, and it is obviously very symbolic about a relationship of the child with the light. In fact, I've talked about this as being heliotropic, right, the way that sunflowers will turn towards the light. In numerous before and after photographs, the contrast between light and dark is also often emphasized to maximum intensity, with the before photos often taking place in darkened interiors, as you can see here, to contrast with the patient's extreme pallor. And then the after photographs that are usually shot outdoors or in front of white backgrounds to heighten their bronze tealed skin. They also display subtle differences that enhance their healed state. New haircuts, polished styles, and smiling faces. The effect, I think, is highly convincing. Explaining comments by physicians about seemingly miraculous recoveries, As Dr. Monteus once declared, and I quote, "The regenerating action of the sun is so profound that it produces actual resurrections." The photographs of children laughing and playing in the sunlight, or of happy results in the after pictures, correlate to declarations by doctors that light treatment produced relief and happiness, and even euphoria, in the patient. In other visual instances, however, patients are being treated in such a way as to suggest tremendous discomfort with the procedure. Held down, encased, bound by the hands of a nurse, or by cloth, or by leather straps. A photograph from Monell's 1902 manual is even more extreme. We have here a patient blindfolded, one assumes in lieu of the protective goggles, arms grasping his chair, shirtless and motionless in front of an electric light machine that resembles a large gun more than a lamp. And this is not only confined to artificial light treatment. In fact, I didn't include this series of images in the exhibition for several reasons. There were initial concerns from the Osler staff about child nudity. But in the end, I excluded these plates because I still don't know what to think about these images. The androgyny of the child, the child being pushed into the frame by the nurse, and the nudity being, to my mind, simply unnecessary. However, we have little indication of the patient's personal experience of the process and of the treatment, and they remain anonymous entities within these manuals. In other cases, models or stand-ins who are clearly not patients turn up to demonstrate the techniques for using phototherapeutic equipment, as we can see here in the Macintosh advertisement. By the 1920s, physicians such as Kellogg began incorporating images that appear more like contemporaneous advertisements. And this is easily the best image of our whole exhibition. Unlike the photographs of patients being treated by phototherapy for lupus, those sort of gruesome before and after photos, here we are presented with a fresh-faced, smiling model, coiffed in the latest 1920s crop. The impression is that this phototherapeutic treatment is neither uncomfortable nor distressing, but in fact an enjoyable process. The ambiguity of her surroundings, resembling a photographer's studio, is heightened by the impossibilities of the scene. You can see that the rays of the lamp, which appear itself to be hand-drawn, amazingly shine on her chest and yet continue beyond her undisturbed. And note her poise, the artificiality of her body position, and even her heels. Clearly, this is no patient. And clearly, this is not a photograph. Layers of representation complicate my reading of what's happening here. It is all in all an odd thing, made even more odd by its context. It's from a book that is specifically addressed, as you can see in the bottom title, to students and practitioners of phototherapy, therefore not for the lay public or even for the patient. In images of the arc light on the model's torso, we are given a privileged, eroticized view of female flesh, clad in Art Deco attire and frilly undergarments. Her hairstyle and clothing are in keeping with the date of the second edition. This is the 1927 edition. The extreme artifice of this, of her pose, of her status as patient, of her supposed usage of the device, and of the photograph's manipulation itself, is made all the more resonant when viewed side by side with the image from Kellogg's original first edition from 1910. So in other words, this is the same subject. The text of the 1910 and 1927 editions are virtually the same, but these are the two different representations that Kellogg has chosen to include in his publication. Paired together, the effect is one of freedom as opposed to constraint, enjoyment to indifference, pleasure to discomfort. The way in which I approach these texts and images, as both an art and a medical historian, is difficult because it requires constant critical awareness that I'm dealing here with material that is at once document and representation. A postcard from the 1920s, for instance, exemplifies my concern. Are we looking at an inescapable fact, that is, children happily undergoing treatment on the beach, or a highly convincing construction of heliotherapeutic treatment on children which presents itself as enjoyable, communal, safe, and fortifying? One might unthinkingly approach this postcard as documentary, right? It happened here on these patients in this location at this time. But one could also approach the postcard as a seemingly innocent snapshot of an event that was then curiously modified into a postcard and then mass circulated by, in some cases, the patients themselves who are writing home to their parents, which is what happens on the back of this postcard. I feel then that I must contextualize postcards like these with a text that describe light therapy not only as indisputably therapeutic via this observable scientific data, right, the charts, the before and after photographs, but also as ancient, pagan, pleasurable, and indeed miraculous via happy, relaxed bodies, smiling for the camera, or an evocative prose-like vocabulary like Galvin's. So if my research is guided by such visual and textual material, I'm compiling a history of therapeutic practices perceived as simultaneously scientifically advanced and, for all intents and purposes, magically healing. Indeed, Kellogg used these exact descriptions in his 1910 book, Light Therapeutics, and I quote, "Under the magic influence of these miracle-working rays, the elements found in earth, air, and water are organized into molecular groups, some comprising thousands of atoms, the breaking up of which, as the result of vital activity, liberates the light energy employed in holding together these organic unities, permitting the energy thus set free to manifest itself in muscular and mental effort and various other forms of vital work." Note not only his use of the words magic and miracle working, but the metaphors of power and liberation to describe the process of light upon life. The photographs and other illustrations in light therapy manuals provide that conviction. The after picture convinces us of the efficacy of the treatment, of its magic. But are the physical processes at work here to create that effect, that magic, those of the light treatment or of the photographic process? So by way of conclusion, the historical relationship between sunlight and health in modern Western cultures has only begun to be explored. And yet it's fundamental to contextualizing current debates in the medical and popular press on the benefits and the risks of light exposure, particularly regarding skin cancers, but also things like seasonal affective disorder. So too is this research valuable at a time of increasing public concern of the impact of climate change. It's a fitting time, then, to return to the origins of our modern relationship with sunlight. I do not pretend to have that history laid out in its entirety before you. But I do present a beginning. Thank you. I have written an exhibition guide, and we're hoping to put it up on the website in some sort of future period as a PDF so that you can just download it. And we have some copies, though, at the front of the exhibition. You can take it around, but if you just could please leave it on display for everybody else, that'd be great. So I'll leave that there for now. I'm happy to take questions if you have any. I'll try my best. Chris.
Thank you very much, Tanya.
You're welcome.
Wonderful. Very evocative, very intriguing. The question of course, readers or audience comes to mind with these and in trying to interpret some of the images, trying to differentiate between potentially medical audiences as opposed to popular audiences, although it's ambiguous in the Kellogg example. Mm. Supposedly for a medical audience, but you had this highly eroticized image. By the way, I have to point out, that copy of that book, which we purchased for the exhibition, had that illustration and that illustration alone torn out from it.
Yeah.
So it was definitely a popular image. Is there an emergence of a sort of a health holiday movement that this is playing into, where you're not dealing with people who are tubercular or ill in any way, but just concerned about health in general, degeneration, and hence would be potential paying customers for sanatoria?
Yeah, I think in some cases you'll find that the sanatoria will explicitly say, not for the contagious. So they sort of say, we don't actually want any tubercular people. Like, that's not, we don't want to spread that around. So in other cases, I think that it's hard to say that there was a kind of a trickle-down effect where it started off as something explicitly medical and then became normalized as just holiday fun. And I think that's actually the kind of way in which secondary sources would normally position that, that it somehow just got popularized. I think actually that there's other things happening, because if you look at Rollier's work, it continues all the way into the 1940s. So it can't just chronologically just move into something like suddenly Coco Chanel just shows up on the promenade of Saint-Tropez and says, here we go. Like, now it's just an aesthetic trend. Like, I don't think it's really emptied out of its medical function, but I do think that, that the concept of sunlight and health was certainly naturalized in popular consciousness, whether that be because of these images, whether it be because of the text, or the kind of constancy of seeing this around. But certainly the idea of going on a health holiday precedes the heliotherapy. I mean, it's 19th century. So it's part of climate therapy as well. So certainly that sunlight and health were linked far before this. Yeah, I don't know if I've answered your question.
You have, yeah.
Okay.
I think you've extended it beyond.
And I think that heliotherapy can be argued to say, I think I can argue that it actually was drawn out of climatotherapy, which is a much older practice and a much more ubiquitous practice, I suppose. Like, it just was everywhere. It was the thing that made the Côte d'Azur. Yeah.
So it would actually have some resonance then with early 20th century viewers, because there would have been a tradition already of...
Yeah, I think it was considered to be, I think it was posited as instinctual to naturalize it as a normal activity. I think what's happening in the images, though, are really not normal, like in terms of the actual treatment procedures. I think by the even the early Rollier images start off with these kinds of pictures of the kids in the sunlight having fun. So I don't even think that it's just a 1920s and beyond thing. So I think, I mean, Rollier's work itself is really fascinating. It doesn't seem to, like, chronologically move in one direction. It's, like, all over the place. And in the same publications, you get really different things happening in the same book. So that's why I think I can't quite position historically what's happening in terms of the visualization as a kind of, like, the trends to how you're going to visualize this. Because it's, like, constantly odd, like, throughout the whole... It's a variable through the whole way through. Yeah, so I find it really hard to kind of... know the history of that from looking at the pictures.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Professor White.
To even further problematize what you just said, you know, I think it's, you can't just talk about medical and non-medical, because there are different kinds of medical. For instance, Kellogg would have normally been placed in the lunatic fringe of what was going on in American medicine, or at least the naturalistic, the naturopathic trend of what was going on in American medicine. Whereas people who were experimenting with heliotherapy for tuberculosis or lupus were in a rather different, you know, they weren't concerned with overall health, they were concerned in a kind of very reductionist kind of therapeutic way, with finding specific therapies for specific illnesses. So that's kind of one kind of distinction that I think is worth making.
Okay.
How widespread, the fact that something appears in a medical journal or is written by a doctor, especially in the United States, or in Germany, doesn't mean very much, because you have so many things that are going on. The other, and I think you're absolutely right, it does come out of climate therapy, mineral waters, ocean therapy, which develops during this period. Climate therapy, by the way, comes fairly late. The successes of mineral water stations incite a lot of other people to extend this kind of health tourism to a variety of other things. But the other side of it, the thing that really interests me, the side of me that you didn't really touch on, is yes, there is this faith in the Son, but there's also great fear. There's also great fear about the damage that the Son can do. And one of the things that was really very, very striking to me in some of the work that I did in the 20s and 30s, there was a whole movement that focused on sunstorms and the effect of sunstorms on health. There were actually serious surgeons who were doing statistics on the relationship between success in successive operations and sunstorms. And of course, if you're looking for it, they were finding correlations between bad effects and sunstorms. So the Son always kind of had this kind of a dual, which is not surprising from the therapy, because anything that's likely to help can be dangerous. Same is true of mineral water.
Sure.
So there was also this mixture of fear. Did you find any of that or is your focus on it kind of the good effects?
I think that you can certainly say that the kind of obsession with explaining that it's safe would indicate that there were fears that they needed to squash, if you know what I mean. I mean, Montaigne is quoted as saying that heliophobia now belongs to another age, and that's from 1907. So I think actually, but the fact that he needed to say that would probably indicate that in fact it still was very widespread. Now the other thing is, I think one of the reasons why people think that heliotherapy didn't really start, or sun tanning didn't start until the 1920s, is because of this fear of, this beautification to be white, right? This idea of being pale as being beautiful. I've actually found quite a lot of material much earlier than the 1920s that would suggest otherwise, in the sense that. But again, is it a physician trying to? As in explaining that the suntan is a very beautiful thing, and in the sense that here the healed body is a beautiful body, enclosed and bronzed and whole in a way. So I think there's this other trend but it's happening in a medical frame rather than a kind of aesthetic frame. Like, I don't think that it's simply Coco Chanel who associates sun tanning with beauty. I think that there's obviously something happening before then that would suggest this. But I agree that there were also, at the same time, still many, many advertisements having the whitening powders and the whitening lotions as well happening at the same time. So I find it hard to kind of make an easy chronology out of this because it doesn't exist. Now, as for the quackery side of it...
Alternative.
What does surprise me is the kind of prevalence of, like, the Nobel sanctioning of this.
Oh, but you see, for me, the key word, what makes the distinction for me is, I think, what's his name, Montesaius, is this a cure for everything, like Montesaius, for chronic disease, or is this a specific cure for lupus? Or is this a specific cure for tuberculosis? That, for me, is the dividing line between what is happening in medicine in the early 20th century and this earlier persisting, looking for a kind of a universal remedy.
Yeah, a kind of like a one-off universal regenerative agent. I think what's the strange thing is, if you read these manuals, they do both. So in the one hand, Montaigne's sanatorium in Silverbell will list all of the things that they treat, right? And then they'll say no contagious people, and so then that would seem to be a kind of more holistic cure, and it was complemented by the sea bathing, with the massage, with the douche, with the eating of the yogurt, all of that stuff, right? With the stuff that Kellogg also was doing. But then you look at someone like Roguier. Roguier advocated a total body treatment. He in fact was very specific by saying that he wouldn't have just aimed the sunlight here at this woman's face just for the lupus lesion. And yet you can see that they, in fact, he sections his books by malady. So you'll see that despite having a one-off method, right, that kind of 5-5-5-5-5 method, he was treating very specific illnesses and monitoring those very specific illnesses. So again, it's hard to say that...
He was treating many illnesses. I think that's really important.
But still quite clear that he was treating specific ones for specific reasons. I mean, he focused on bone and joint tuberculosis, on Pott's disease. The lupus stuff I found interesting in the heliotherapy rather than in the phototherapy is though that he's trying to compete with it and say, we can do it naturally just as well as they can do it artificially. So I think, I feel like there's not a one heliotherapy camp who are all in the kind of alternative side. That's why it's, I feel, and then, of course, then we have this international framework of it where Rollier is doing stuff in Switzerland his way, and then Monteus is down in the south of France with his group, and also in considering themselves very just naturist, which, of course, is an interesting loaded word, and then Kellogg is doing his stuff over there. So I guess trying to, like, universalize it as a one-off therapy I find very difficult to do. I don't know whether it should be done, actually. But the one thing that I do want to stress is the attitude that I've seen by other historians towards heliotherapy is very trivializing. In the same way, like, did you ever see that Kellogg book and the movie that had Anthony Hopkins in it, The Road to Wellville? I mean, that's kind of characterizes the attitude towards Kellogg, that he was just like ridiculous character. And I think actually it's not a very productive attitude to have from a scholarly point of view. And I find that that is what happens when people look at heliotherapy. It's kind of castigated as this like silly thing, this novel thing. And because of it, I don't think people have really paid much attention to the text nor the images. So I find that I have a difficult task, and I don't know whether it's an impossible task, but certainly I would like to know how to somehow write that magic monograph to make it all fair.
And we look forward to it.
Yeah.
We have maybe time for one more question.
Okay.
The picture that showed the girl up on the ledge with the fence that you considered a bit gratuitous. I was curious that she was above the fence, you know, above the barrier, as if perhaps it was also a symbol of overcoming the illness, which perhaps there's no before and after in that case, but I wondered if it was a symbol of the after, having conquered already whatever the illness or ill health was.
The language that Rollier uses, and in fact a lot of heliotherapists use, make a lot of associations between, make a lot of symbolism between children and flowers. I haven't seen it in terms of a kind of you could have made symbolic references to the mountains and the heights of that, but actually the one thing that really prevails with Rollier's language is with children being like flowers going towards the light. I think, but I agree that this image is a symbolic thing more than anything else. I agree it's a very beautiful thing as well. That's why it's like right in the middle of the exhibition. I do find it gratuitous as well. There is something about this that I find, about these kinds of images that I find unsettling.
My question? Why? I mean, to me this is an image of health. This is youth, and vigor and health. It's exactly the kind of image that you would want to show if you wanted to indicate the healthful properties of something.
Okay. If I was being an art historian, I would point out bits about it that I find slightly uncomfortable, like here. That, to me, is unnecessary. And from a point of view of thinking about a 1944 picture of a young girl on a balcony, I find it unnecessary. So I agree that it is a picture of health, but I think it's a loaded image with some tensions in it. And I agree that it would definitely depend on the viewer and the viewer's sort of moral positioning and this is certainly me speaking from 2011. How it was taken at the time, it's hard to say. But Rollier was at pains to say on several occasions that I believe that children are totally morally like allowed to be out nude in the sunlight, and that we should let them go and be unfettered in that light, and the nudity is totally normal and fine, and a kind of like trying to make it okay. I would say that there's a lot of that type of explanation in the books as well. This one doesn't upset me more though as much as the other one. This one I find very odd. It is like almost surrealist in the imaging of it. So,
in the context of medical journals of the period.
The blindfolding, I understand, for the anonymity.
They're very, very graphic. Medical photography is extraordinarily graphic in the 1890s and early 1900s.
But does that make it unproblematic, or?
Well, I mean, you can analyze, you know, what it is about. I mean, it's the same thing as touching the body. There's a certain leeway that is allowed the medical in either touching or exposing the body that is not allowed anywhere else. And I do know people who have made the link to art historians who have made the link to pornography, but it's also very, very characteristic of medical photography. I mean, you open up almost any medical journal and you will see pictures of this sort, a lot of them. So there's nothing specific about heliotherapy.
I wouldn't suggest that this is just a heliotherapeutic technique at all, and I think either is the before and after, obviously. I guess I'm coming from the perspective of people like Mary Hunter and Anthea Callan, who've looked at the kind of erotics of medical photography and medical imaging and medical objects, and explored that area, perhaps in a way that others don't, but yeah. Maybe it is a purely a 2011 hindsight thing as well. It's hard to say.
Oh, I don't think so at all. I think it is odd. Even if it's not uncommon, I think it certainly is odd. I don't like that she has her hand up under her arm.
It's actually a boy.
Oh, well,
which is even more interesting.
It's a bit ambiguous.
Yeah, I think it's that androgyny, I find.
Yeah. But my question before was going to be about I don't know if it's a disconnect or a tension about the general pictures and general openness of people receiving sun therapy, you know, in the line of the beds or out on the deck or that sort of thing, and then the regimented program. And I wondered if maybe some of that regimenting of a program of 5 minutes for here and then 10 minutes and whatever, or that obviously turn up in the various manuals, if that is an attempt to place into a scientific language.
Oh, sure, yeah. It's to justify it, isn't it? Like,
yeah,
to say, we are a real therapy here.
A practice to back up a theory.
The interesting thing is also, in the beginning of manuals, they always need to say something about Galen and Celsus and Hippocrates to kind of justify that what they're doing is based on venerated ancient medicine. And now they're going to bring it into a modern framework, and they're going to systematize it and make sure that we all understand that this is progressive and proper. So I agree that there is... Do you think actually in that way you're suggesting that the images are a way of convincing about the regimentation of it and the system?
I wondered if the images were a little bit more true, and the writing up of different processes or procedures might be... might have come after.
Oh, that's very interesting.
And then maybe, I don't know, if some of the literature tries to test some of these processes, or if they're just attempts to be scientific.
That's a great question. Thank you very much. Do we have time for more, or...
I have one short question about measles.
About measles.
You talked about measles, about the...
About smallpox.
Oh, well, the smallpox, not measles. Okay.
I do want to say I'm not a physician, so...
No, I know.
I can't diagnose.
I remember as a kid, you know, if you had measles, you were in a room, the window, the shades are drawn, it was meant to be dark, and that would have been in the early 50s.
Really?
Yeah. Any doctors in the room say, is that what...
Dr. Zivers? Did any more? Did you want to say anything, Dr. Swartz?
I wanted to know what the Pinson Institute says in appraisal of the work of Pinson.
Do you mean like what their official position was?
Yes.
Oh, nowadays?
Yes. What are they devoted to?
Oh, I don't know if it still exists. I'm not sure that it does. I'll look. I'll see where if it still exists. I just know that it was renamed, and then in sort of in honor of him, but I don't know how long it ran until. Any? Well, we can chat at the exhibition. You can just mull around. I'll be there. Yeah?
I'd like to just again thank Tanya for the wonderful talk. And I think she goes to help prove one of my favorite beliefs in being involved in the Ulster Library, that the only limits to what we can do with the collection is the limits of our own imagination. So you've taken the collection and looked at it in a completely new way and enlightened us.
Oh, that's a good one.
With your illuminating talk.
Yeah,
I can keep going for a while.
Keep going, it's good.
And I want to invite you all to bask in the glow of the exhibition. I really am. Sorry.
It took a while.
Yeah, it's two floors below. If you haven't been to the Ulster Library, so just when you get out of the elevator or down the stairs, just turn to your left, and we'll reconvene there for a look at the actual exhibition. Thanks again.
Thank you for coming.